Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, three different interviews. The first with the Speaker of the House of the U.S. House of Representatives, Paul Ryan. In part two, we will be hearing from an author of a book called The Moment, which offers some thoughts on how all of us can lead more thoughtful, mindful lives. Stay with us. And it's certainly an honor to be beginning today's morning show with none other than the U.S. Speaker of the House of Representatives, Paul Ryan. Speaker Ryan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Hey, morning, Greg. How are you doing this morning?
Fine. Good to be catching up with you. We have lots to talk about, but I, of course, need to ask you a couple of questions about becoming Speaker of the House. One of the things I am especially curious about is what was the most significant factor that prompted you to pursue this, given the fact that for a fairly significant amount of time, other people seemed a lot more interested in you being Speaker than you yourself were interested in being Speaker. What ended up tipping the balance?
That's for sure. It was really the fact that no one else could get the votes to become Speaker. That's basically why I ended up doing it. It became very clear that I was the one who had the ability to get the majority of votes from the Republicans that were required to be elected by your party. You need 218 votes to get elected Speaker, and I had 238 from my party. No one else had 218, and that is effectively why I more or less agreed to do it. That what would have been the alternative, we believed, was the prior Speaker, John Boehner, would have stayed in power with Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats supplying with the majority of the votes. That's the situation we saw unfolding, and what we would have seen would have been just an incredible amount of turmoil in Congress. And, you know, just when we thought we'd hit rock bottom, I thought it would get worse. And so I basically was not interested in doing this job, but I came to terms with this realization and redesigned the job and had a number of, you know, sort of terms that I presented to my colleagues about what I thought would be necessary to do the job successfully and to do it well. Number one, I live in Janesville. You know, I'm leaving my home just this morning here on the way to the airport for session. And I spend my weekends in the district with my family doing constituent events, and I'm not going to stop that. Most speakers don't do that. They travel the country on behalf of their members all through the weekends. Well, I have a young family, and most speakers don't do that either. They're usually older people who are empty nesters. So I had to do the job differently. That plus I wanted to make sure that we were for something, that we become a proposition party instead of just an opposition party, and that's what we're working on now here in 2016. So I basically laid out a series of circumstances that I thought were necessary to complete in order to do the job well, and I'm glad to report that is the case, and we are, I am doing it the way I wanted to do it. I wanted to make it less of a political job, more of a policy and communications job, and I wanted Congress to go back to what we call regular order, to running Congress the way it was meant to be run, where members of Congress have a better chance at actually shaping and crafting legislation organically. And that means that the leadership doesn't necessarily predetermine the outcome of everything, that it's not so tightly controlled, which I think people were chafing under that kind of a system. And I think people asked me to do this job because they sort of know I felt that way. And the other reason I think people asked me to do it is because they knew I never wanted to do it. So they thought I'd be more responsible with the so-called power you get with a job instead of trying to, you know, acquire it to yield it in an irresponsible way, which is what people sometimes fear, among others.
What is the biggest difference, if there is a significant difference, in the way your fellow representatives now view you now that you are Speaker? I mean, for instance, as you pass in the hall, as you are in meetings and so on, what sort of special new deference are you treated with now?
Well, I guess I went from being, you know, one of the quarterbacks or the players on the team to being the head coach. You know, let's just look at the Green Bay Packers. You know, I was probably, you know, as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee and chairman of the Budget Committee, I was, you know, a critical player, you know, maybe something important like a running back or Jordy Nelson or maybe even an Aaron Rodgers on given issues. Now I'm Mike McCarthy. You know what I mean? I basically went from a starting player to the head coach. And I think they sort of view me more in that way, which is not as one of the players in the lineup, but probably the coach kind of calling the plays. So I think that's kind of the way they view me more or less. I've been in Congress a number of years, and I've got a lot of good friends, and I think people know that I'm very passionate about issues and ideas and not as much about politics, not as much about power, but about ideas. And I think they like the idea of a policymaker, an ideas person, being in the speakership than other forms of political leaders.
How would you characterize your relationship with President Obama, and what kind of meetings have you had with him since becoming Speaker?
I haven't had a lot of meetings with him. We've spoken over the phone, you know, probably, I don't know, a half a dozen times, I would just guess off the top of my head. We get along fine. We very much disagree with each other on so many of the big issues, but we do operate from a position of what I would call mutual respect. We have a similar family situation where we have, you know, my daughter's 13, his are a little older than that, but we have young kids at home. And so we have a few common bonds. He's a Chicago guy, I'm a Wisconsin guy, Midwest. We have a few things that we have common that we discuss, love of sports. I'm having lunch with him, I think, tomorrow. I know I have a meeting with him as well tomorrow. So we're going to basically sit down and figure out what this year can we find common ground on things that we agree on and advance those. We did that on education reform. We did that on transportation and tax reform at the end of this last year. So we're going to see, picking up where we left off, getting some big things done in November and December. What is it that can get done now? We disagree on so many of the big issues. And I think my personal approach to this is, you can disagree with a person without being disagreeable. You can disagree with a person based on philosophy or principle or policy without impugning motives and things like that. So I think because that's always been sort of the way I have taken this attitude, we have a cordial relationship, but definitely we don't see eye to eye on many things. And so we do it, I think, in a fairly mutually respectful way.
There are certainly plenty of politicians in the country right now who are really afraid of being seen as a seeker of common ground, as someone open to compromise and so on. It sounds like those remain important principles for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think you can do both. The way I describe it is, let's go figure out what we can get done. We've got to make government work, and there are things like criminal justice reform is one of the issues we talk about. We have a prison problem. We have people in deep poverty coming out of prison and not having any chance of getting a lifeline and getting their life back together. I think there's things we can do to make that better. So there's an issue where conservatives and liberals, in a funny way, kind of agree. So, okay, that's great. Let's get that done. But there are a lot of issues where we just do not agree. And that's the challenge, which is, we think we should offer alternatives. And that's where you can be spirited in offering alternatives, in opposing by having better proposition, but also, you know, where you can find common ground getting that done too. So you don't have to choose one or the other. I think you can do both.
We're speaking on today's morning show, part one of today's program, with U.S. Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. We're, of course, speaking on the eve of the Iowa caucuses, and I couldn't possibly let by the opportunity to ask you, first of all, what has most surprised you about what has transpired thus far in Iowa on the eve of the caucuses there?
I think the whole thing's unpredictable. I'm completely neutral because of my position as Speaker of the House. I'm actually the chairman of a convention in July, so I've got to be very neutral. But I think the whole thing's unpredictable. I think the rise of Donald Trump is obviously surprising. I don't think people expected him to be on top of the polls for as long as he has. But I think this whole thing's unpredictable. I think the way the states are configured with the electoral, how you win delegates, a lot of more states are now proportional, meaning it's not winner-take-all states. So that means this thing could go on for a long time. If Donald Trump runs the table and sews it up early, that's one conceivable scenario. But my guess is because this thing's so unpredictable and because you have more proportional voting and less winner-take-all states like you did before, you could see a fairly lengthy process this time.
Mr. Trump, according to every study I've read, seems to be riding a wave of anti-Washington, anti-government frustration and anger out there. Do you see any significant lessons to be learned by the mainstream Republican Party by Mr. Trump's success? What can you guys learn from this?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. I share that frustration, by the way, which is, I think the last 7 years, and at the end of the Bush administration as well, government was not meeting its potential in any clear measurement. I mean, that's why people are frustrated. Look at the economy. We've been under 3% growth. We've been slow growth for 10 years, slowest growth period in the modern era at around 2% growth. That means people's wages aren't increasing. That means people are worried about losing their jobs. And then you have terrorism knocking on our door as Americans. We see it here in our own country now, ISIS, you know, with its own caliphate. And so I think that the anxiety is palpable, and they see government as incompetent in addressing that. I do believe that a lot of this is because of Barack Obama's policies and his leadership, or lack thereof. And so that frustration is spilling over. And that is why I believe those of us who are in what we call the opposition party can't just complain about it. We can't just, you know, yell about it. We've got to show how we would do something, how we would fix it, what we would do about it. And that's what I am working on getting our party in the House of Representatives to do, and that is our focus of 2016. It's been the primary reason why I agreed to take the speakership, is to make sure that we go on offense on ideas and offer the country answers to these problems that have been so vexing for so long and that people are legitimately really upset and frustrated about.
It sounds like I'm not going to get you to voice a preferred candidate among those vying right now.
Yeah, I don't do that. Like I said, because of my unique role, I don't do that. I think this thing's going to take probably a while to figure out. But I think that this frustration comes from the fact that we are on the wrong track. Government is going in the wrong direction. The country is going in the wrong direction. People are upset about it, and they want to see something fixed about it. And that is why I think we see what we see on TV these days.
United States Speaker of the House Paul Ryan, a great pleasure to connect with you again, and we look forward to speaking again on the morning show. Safe travels to you and best wishes.
You bet, Greg. Thanks so much. Take care.
The time now, 8:23 on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. Our thanks to Speaker Paul Ryan for making time in his busy schedule. He actually spoke to us via cell phone as he was traveling from his home in Janesville to fly back to Washington. We look forward to more conversations with Speaker Ryan. This is the morning show, the Monday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two of today's program. We will be spending this portion of WGTD's morning show talking about how we can and indeed must learn to live in the moment and experience the moment, to not get so caught up in a frantic race through life that we end up sort of skimming the surface and not experiencing life in all of its depth and richness. The book at hand is called The Moment, A Practical Guide to Creating a Mindful Life in a Distracted World. And I suspect that this is a book and a message that will speak very directly to many of you, as it certainly speaks to me. The author of the book is Achim Novak, who has written extensively on this topic and has worked with people in all kinds of different situations and settings on this sort of transformative work, which can really make a huge difference. He has been featured on National Public Radio and Fox News and 60 Minutes and so on. He has written a couple of previous books. And again, this newest book, which I'm so glad to be talking about, is published by New Page Books, a division of Career Press, again called The Moment, A Practical Guide to Creating a Mindful Life in a Distracted World. Achim Novak, we welcome you to the morning show.
It is my pleasure. Hello, Greg.
Glad to be talking to you today. Before we talk specifically about the book, could we get a sense of when this sort of overall topic or concept first became really important to you on a personal level before it became, in a sense, your primary professional pursuit?
My first career was in show business in New York. I was a professional theater director and acting coach. And I know you work with music a lot, so you understand the business. And I was a completely career-obsessed workaholic theater director. My feeling was always, if I don't take the next job, I will never work again. And then at some point, I just felt like I was in my mid-30s, like enough of that life. And I ran off to the small island of Tobago for a year, which is an island of 30,000 people. I windsurfed. I became a good windsurfer. I read a lot of books. And in the end, I realized that's not the life I wanted either. So I went from one end to the other, but I really began to think about how do I want to experience my life? And that's where the journey began.
Mm-hmm. I really love the way that this book is laid out. And I also appreciate the fact in which it is surprisingly clear and specific, given the fact that we are talking mm-hmm. about a number of different concepts that one
yes.
can talk about in very vague terms, and sometimes the people who talk about it seem to gravitate consciously to the vaguest terms possible, and throwing around terms that where we end up wondering, what in the world does that really mean? Of course, at the heart of this is something mentioned in the subtitle of the book, mindfulness, living a mindful life. For you, what does that mean?
Two things. One, it means richly savoring, or as richly as we can, savoring every moment that we're in. And the mindful part is being conscious of the drama and the chatter and the story that we have about the moment that we're in. It's impossible to not have some of it going on, but witnessing it and deciding, is this chatter helpful, or is it inhibiting a potentially richer moment?
To you, I thought it was interesting that you share a story about one of your first efforts to, in a sense, combat this notion of rushing
yes.
through life. It was you were in your mid-20s. You had
yes.
read something by somebody whose work you admired and embarked on sort of your own concocted experiment in mindfulness, which involved the stairway of the building where you lived. Tell our listeners about this. It's a great story.
Yes, this was a youthful experiment of mine, and I decided that I wanted to live more fully in every moment. So my experiment was, I lived in a four-story walk-up apartment in the DuPont Circle area of Washington, D.C., and I said, let me just walk up as slowly as I can and really experience the physical reality of that walk. And that was a 10-day experiment, and it took me up to 40 minutes to climb the four stairs, and I saw every little crack, every little piece of dirt on the floor, the lighting. And what I learned from that 10 days, the walk up the stairs was just the walk up the stairs. It didn't need to become anything more. And I was trying to turn it into something bigger than what it was. So some moments are simple, are transactional, which is what that was. And other moments have richer layers to it. And I invite our readers and me to really play with the layers a little bit. That particular walk was just a walk. There were not a lot of layers to it. And it was almost liberating to know I can just walk up the darn stairs. And it's fine.
Right. Well, and I guess, yes. Well, and I think that's one of the things that makes your book a bit more approachable and accessible than some books that are written in sort of this same general sphere. Is
yep.
that I appreciate, in a sense, the sort of level-headedness and sense of practicality to which you address some of these issues. Before we get into the four keys that you spell out, uh-huh. I want to take a moment to talk about actually a lovely German phrase that I don't remember hearing before that you talk about. In many respects, this is at the heart of what mindful living is all about. The German term, ein Augenblick. Explain to our listeners what this term literally means and what it means for you, in a sense.
I appreciate how beautifully you pronounced that. Thank you, Greg. That was nice. Ein Augenblick means literally in German, if you translate, it's within the blink of an eye. But Germans tend to say it when, like, wait a minute. If somebody says, couldn't you come over to me? And you say, oh, ein Augenblick, I'll be there in a minute. But the phrase within a blink of an eye is very powerful to me, because within a blink of an eye, I can notice something around me that could change the rest of my life. Within a blink of an eye, that very same stimulus could also disappear and it's gone forever. So within the blink of an eye, everything can happen, but it's our job to notice and then choose about how we want to respond. And that's the joy and also the difficult part about noticing what happens within the blink of an eye.
Mm. We're speaking with Achim Novak about his book, The Moment, A Practical Guide to Creating a Mindful Life in a Distracted World. Towards that end, in order to experience life in a more mindful state, if you will, you spell out four keys that you think can make a very, very critical difference, the first of which speaks very directly to what you were just saying, the importance of awakening our senses. I mean, that is, in a sense, the gateway through which everything comes into our lives or rushes right past us without really, really penetrating. You spell out the beauty of an incredibly simple exercise, which is not even meditation.
But it might at a glance
look like that. Tell our listeners that simple experiment that could get them started on this path towards the senses being awakened.
And maybe just to create some context, every actor, and I admire actors, actors are trained to live richly and fully in the moment. And one of the first things that every actor does when he or she goes to acting school, they do some exercises to heighten their awareness of the five senses. And this is a simple exercise, and anybody who listens, you can do this on your own. And I love the fact you clarified this is not meditating, but lie on the floor in a room somewhere, a room you know comfortably. I suggest you lie down for 5 minutes, and if you worry about how quickly 5 minutes go by, just set a timer, close your eyes, and just listen to the sounds around you. And you will be amazed at what you hear. And the aha moment for me is always after 5 minutes, those sounds are there all the time. Like, that's the physical central reality, but we're too busy to notice. And I don't think everything has to be noticed, but how sweet it is to notice some of them and choose whether we want to notice or not. So give yourself those 5 minutes. It's easy to do. Close your eyes, listen, and you'll be amazed at what you hear.
Hmm. It's a really lovely chapter of the book, and you spell out a lot of wonderful suggestions that I think could make a huge difference for people, including what you call the prerequisite of evicting the debris of the past before we can really experience this in its fullness. I want us to talk about the second key, which is about meaning. Your second key is crave meaning. And you actually talk about one of the world's greatest golfers as you begin this discussion.
Well, Jordan Spieth, when I was writing the book, I'm inspired by athletes. I think they do amazing things. I'm inspired by young athletes who achieve great things at an early age. And, you know, Jordan Spieth is one of those amazing golfers who's accomplished great stuff at the age of 20, or I think he's 21 now. But when you win a big title, the meaning of that is actually pretty straightforward. It's a great win. You worked for it. It's a crowning moment. And I quote Jordan Spieth as he talks about winning the Masters in Augusta, Georgia. But meaning, the two ways to look at it. Psychologists often teach us to make meaning of something after an event. We know that we've had a rough year, we've recovered from the year, and then we look back and go, what the heck was that year all about? And we make sense of it afterwards. The kind of meaning that, because this book is called The Moment, that I think is the sweetest is when we discover meaning in the middle of a moment as a moment unfolds. And I reference a Buddhist term called prajna, which really talks about the wisdom. We tend to trivialize it by calling intuition, but it's a deep knowing in the moment. And the best kind of example I can give you, because we've all had this, like we meet somebody in a social setting and we get wrapped up in a great conversation, and then suddenly the little voice says, wow, I think this will be a friend for life.
Hmm.
And that little voice, that's prajna wisdom. And the moment that voice speaks to us, we have a deeper appreciation of the conversation that we're in. And that kind of wisdom actually shows up in many different forms and different ways for different people. But people who are, I call, life connoisseurs really have developed a fine way of sensing more meaning as they're in a moment, and in turn appreciate the moments more fully. So I invite all of us to just discover how prajna talks to you. It's not always a voice. It's very personal, and suddenly it will show up everywhere.
Hmm. I also appreciate it in this chapter, which has quite a few different sections, one called Be a Beatnik, which does not really mean exactly what that that term might mean. You're actually talking about the beats of life.
Yeah.
And B-E-A-T-S, we're not talking about the root vegetable, we're talking about, and nor are we talking about beat as in the pulse of music. Mm-hmm. You're using the term beat in a little different way, which I think is a beautiful illustration of so much of what you're talking about.
Well, our days tend to be broken into, I call them beats, but there's a rhythm and structure to our days. The most obvious structure is the scheduling that we do for meetings and other events. But even within a one-hour meeting with somebody, there can be different stretches, different feelings, different experiences. So one beat changes into the next. And the more we are stay conscious of the structure and the way the beats change, the more we notice the meaning within the beats. Like if we're running all day, life becomes one big blur, and there is no meaning to be discovered. We're just running to get things done. But the moment we stop and settle into what I call the beats or the rhythms of the day, that's when the meaning shows itself. So I invite all of us to be conscious of the beats or rhythms of your day, because within them, that's where we discover the meaning that's there.
The third key is called a wave ride energy. And you must know something about body surfing, because you certainly describe it very, very vividly. And it really offers up some beautiful illustrations, some beautiful metaphors about how this can be explored.
Yeah, I'm a great believer that at the deepest level, we experience life energetically. And folks who have an energetic experience of life and can ride the wave, in my experiences, have a richer life. And so we investigate some of the different ways in which we experience energy. But if I want to be very simplistic about it in the book, I think there are the two types of people. There are those folks, when a new stimulus, new information comes your way, which is a form of energy, the impulse is to say, well, let me think about it, and I'll get back to you. And there's situations where that level of reflection is a very helpful response. There are other folks who are confronted with a new stimulus or a new wave of energy, and they say, gosh, let me ride the wave, and let me see what happens here. And sometimes the ride isn't pretty, but we can get off the wave. But those folks tend to create a more adventurous and richly lived life. So I explore a little bit in the book all the different ways in which energy talks to us, how we notice it, and how we choose to respond, and I invite folks to take some risks in getting on the energy ride.
Hmm. And finally, your fourth key is that you invite us to make time stand still. First of all, what is the point of making time stand still, to whatever extent that's even possible?
Well, if time really is an artificial construct, right? But folks who meditate know this. Meditation, when we first meditate, is not a lot of fun, because we notice all the crap that goes on in our brain, and we're conscious of that, but there are three levels of letting go that tend to happen in meditation. One, we begin to detach from the chatter in the mind. We tend to detach from the urge to get up and run around and do stuff, and we tend to let go of the stress in our bodies. And suddenly we get to that place that, that meditators I meditate call the state of bliss or peace. And we don't stay there for long. It's a momentary pleasure. But in that moment, we really lose all sense of time. And it's an exquisite experience. And the one benefit of meditating, for example, first thing in the moment, in the morning, if we reach that state of calm, we're going to get into turbulent waters during the day, but that calm will inform every interaction in the day, and it will change the way we engage with folks. And so that way, if it gets us to a deeper, richer experience of the world, because in that moment, we really forget about time.
Right.
We're in a different space.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. The other almost opposite extreme, and this is one of my favorite experiences, is I like the word flow, or the flow experience, which is the experience, and everybody who listens to this program has had experience when we're so engaged in an activity that we lose all track of time. Like we're doing something for 2 hours and we look at the clock and we go, gosh, I thought I was doing this for 10 minutes. So another invitation for everybody is to find more activities that foster that level of engagement for you, because in the active activities that get us to the flow state, we're so engaged that we lose track of time, and it tends to be a powerful experience for us.
So you see both of these as positives.
I totally do, and they sound like opposites, but they're totally complementary in my mind.
Hmm. One of my favorite moments in this portion of the book is when you write, no matter in which part of your life you slow down, the benefit is always the same, a noticing, a savoring, an appreciation of the subtle, a willingness to be surprised by the ordinary, a richer settling into a moment. Can you say a word about the walks that you take in and around your home just north of Miami?
Yeah, this is where I really call myself on my own crap, if you will. Like I live in Hollywood, Florida, just 30 minutes north of Miami, and I live 6 blocks from a beautiful downtown, and this is a car culture. So I was in the habit of hopping into my car, opening the gate to the alley, driving to the street, driving 6 blocks, and then parking the car somewhere. And I was thinking, wait a minute, you could really just walk downtown. It may sound so obvious, but I had to really, that was a mental switch for me. And as I start walking, you know, I notice more of my neighborhood that I know so well. I notice more of the plants. I see people through windows. You know, I notice a stranger smiling at me as they're walking past me. And I find myself slowing down and savoring the act of getting from my house to a restaurant in downtown. And that sounds so simple, but that's a choice when I'm so used to getting the car to go everywhere. But that's a slowing down as a way of making time stand still a little bit.
Hmm. There is so much to enjoy and savor and take to heart in your book called The Moment, A Practical Guide to Creating a Mindful Life in a Distracted World. It is published by New Page Books, a division of the Career Press, and the author, Akeem Novak. Akeem Novak, thank you so much. I am so glad I read your book and so glad I got to talk with you about it. Very best wishes to you.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Greg.
And the time now, 8:43. This is the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. We finish out today's program with a past interview out of the Morning Show archives. What an honor for me to be speaking for the next few minutes with a former Buddhist monk by the name of Thubten Jinpa, who has served for almost 3 decades as the principal English translator to the Dalai Lama. And he has worked and written extensively on the important topic of Buddhist philosophy, and in particular, the importance of compassion in our lives as individuals and in our collective lives as a society. And he has a new book called A Fearless Heart, How the Courage to Be Compassionate Can Transform Our Lives. The book is published by Hudson Street Press. And Thubten Jinpa, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, Greg.
I would be remiss if we didn't begin by saying just a word about the devastating earthquake in the nation of Nepal, a place I know so near and dear to your heart. I wonder if you could just say a word about, in the midst of such a catastrophe, the very important place that compassion has and the way in which we sometimes see compassion played out in such an awful moment.
Yes, thank you for asking me that question. I know a lot of people personally in Nepal, and so when I first saw the news and saw the images, I was in India, actually in the Himalayas, closer to the Himalayas, and it was just devastating to see those images of, tragedy, unfolding that you could see on the TV. Immediately I, contacted various people that I know to find out what has happened. And also, I encouraged many of my friends that at this point, in addition to feeling sympathy and solidarity with the Nepalese people, it's also important that we act on it. And for those of us who are not on the ground, the most effective way to act is to really try to find the best charitable organization that you can make some contribution to, and then tell your friends so that, it really becomes a kind of grassroots level response and not wait until some institutional or governmental response comes into the picture. And I'm very happy to say that the international response from ordinary people have been amazing. And Nepal, particularly places like Nepal, when there's a tragedy, in addition to the tremendous loss of lives that people experience and the sadness of that loss, but there's also when the properties are lost, it's very, very different from the loss of properties that you experience in the Western world, where you have backups like insurance and so on. Whereas in third world countries like Nepal, there is no such thing as insurance, and once you have lost your home and properties, that's kind of it. And then it will take decades for these family members to build up. So one of the things that is really constantly worrying the survivor's mind is actually how we are going to support ourselves. And winter in that part of the world can be very, very cold. So those are really, very, very, profound suffering. And but the international response at the governmental level as well as individual level has been very, very remarkable. I mean, this is the times when we express the fundamental nature of our humanity, and which is really very encouraging.
Yes. At one point in your book, you quote the famous television host Fred Rogers, his advice to youngsters when they've seen something very disturbing on television, his advice which his own mother gave him: look for the helpers. You will always find people who are trying to help. And of course, you are pointing to exactly
yes.
that.
Yes.
Let's talk about compassion, the topic of your book, something which you say is fundamental to our basic nature as human beings. I wanted to ask you about something you say in the introduction. The aim of this book, you write, is both simple and ambitious. Tell us about that both simple and ambitious aim of your book.
Well, the aim of the book is simple in one sense, that it is really kind of, bringing attention to the, to readers, each one of us as individuals, that compassion is something that is inherent in all of us. It's not something that we need to cultivate, kind of from outside, either through religious services or some kind of, sophisticated education. The compassionate instinct, the quality of compassion, the quality of that heart is naturally in all of us. So in some sense, the message is simple. The compassion itself is something that we instinctively and at the gut level we can all relate to, and we know what it feels like when we feel compassion for someone who is suffering in front of us. But at the same time, the aim of the book is ambitious, which is that, it attempts to show that, we can do something about this very important part of our nature and make compassion, transform it from the state of just the emotional response which gets triggered by a situation to actually a proactive standpoint or a perspective from which we can relate to the world. So in some sense, when we are confronted with a situation, you know, we can respond to the situation out of fear or anger or those other more destructive way of dealing with things. Or we can choose to respond to the situation with understanding, acceptance, and kindness. And whatever route you choose to respond to a situation has huge implications down the line. So that it is ambitious in the sense that I'm suggesting that we can learn to choose to respond to situations predominantly from that part, better part of ourselves. So in some sense, the book is suggesting that we can actually undergo a profound spiritual personal transformation.
One of the things I so appreciate is how you talk about compassion being something that really is part of all of us, and we are meant to be compassionate. And that is contrary to some who would say that the fundamental drive of all human beings is in fact selfishness, self-serving. And you say, in fact, we were born at the mercy of someone else's care. We grew up and survived into adulthood because we received care from others. Even at the height of our autonomy as adults, the presence or absence of others' affection powerfully defines our happiness or misery. This is human nature. It is, we are vulnerable and we need each other. And this is something I think most of us take for granted. I think you state it so beautifully in your book.
Thank you very much. I think it is the paradox is that in the West particularly, where the dominant kind of conception of who we are, I could say the official storyline of who we are as human beings, has been so dominated by a particular version of Darwinian evolutionary theory that emphasizes the survival of the fittest kind of motto, and also the idea that somehow ultimately all human behavior should be explainable by, in terms of a pursuit of self-interest. And this has been a very powerful, influential kind of thinking in the West. And the point I'm trying to make is that, yes, pursuit of self-interest is a powerful drive, and competition is an expression of that. But at the same time, unless we take into account the powerful nurturing instinct and also the caring instinct that we all have, and we in a way also share that with some non-human primates as well, now increasingly research shows. And so unless we take into account that nurturing, caring instinct, which gets expressed in helping and cooperative behavior, we cannot have a full picture of what human nature is, and we cannot fully explain the human evolution into large societies and so on. So that's the point I was trying to make. So that and what we tend to do in the West in contemporary society is to somehow relegate instincts like compassion into a kind of a private domain that we expect from our family, from our friends, and we express it to our family and to our friends within a small circle. Or we relegate it as a kind of a religious value. So if you are religious, you take them seriously, and if you're not religious, you don't need to take them seriously. But the official line and the public kind of story of human beings has no real place for compassion. And this is something that I'm making the case that we need to rethink and reconceptualize what human nature is.
And I so appreciate the fact that at the end of your book, you discuss how compassion is not only to emanate from us as individuals, but that it needs to be woven into something like our healthcare system, our educational system, into the workplace, into industry, into government, to our society as a whole, that compassion needs to be its guiding force.
Thank you very much. Yeah, that's very true, because, for example, if you take like healthcare, I know, for example, in this country, the healthcare is predominantly private sector, whereas where I live in Canada, it's a public sector. But regardless of whether it's a public or a private sector, the healthcare is a particular kind of, service where, the underlying fundamental principle has to be a compassionate concern for the sick, for the needy. And that has to somehow, that ethos has to be at the root of healthcare system. And once we're able to do that, then you know, patients who are walking into a hospital in a healthcare setting, and that, you know, healthcare givers, if they are conscious of their compassionate kind of instinct and the importance of that motivation, it creates a completely different atmosphere. Yes, there needs to be business transactions. Someone has to pay. But at the same time, because of the compassionate ethos, the whole interaction will have a completely different flavor. The same thing goes for education. You know, up until very recently, we have been so obsessed by IQ and intellectual development of children, which is also very, very important because, you know, society gets much more sophisticated and technologically complicated. You know, we need to train and equip our children to be able to deal with that kind of very complex world. But at the same time, you know, we also need to equip our children with the emotional and the social skills to deal with living in a much more complicated and integrated and global world. And in that context, again, education of compassion, education of heart, how to relate to others from the place of compassion and empathy, and how to feel more connected with others, those are going to have huge implications for the personal well-being of younger generation as well as the kind of societies they will create. And I also hope that in government as well as international relations, you know, one of the kind of key ingredient of compassion is the recognition of the basic sameness of all human beings, you know. And so the key point the compassion is making is that principle of compassion is making is that when confronted with a need and suffering, whose need or suffering it is should not really matter. If it is suffering, it needs to be relieved. It needs to be, you know, if there is a need, someone needs to be helped. So this recognition of the oneness of humanity really has to somehow brought into, you know, our dealing with people from different, you know, ethnicity or different language, different religion, and different cultures. And you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama often points out that the one of the greatest challenges of 21st century is going to be peaceful coexistence, because as world gets smaller and as cultures come into contact with each other in a much more, you know, day-to-day basis, the ability to accept differences and also, you know, accept differences on the basis of recognition of the fundamental oneness of human family is going to be crucial. And this is where the compassion education can really make a big difference.
The book, again, is A Fearless Heart, How the Courage to Be Compassionate Can Transform Our Lives, published by Hudson Street Press. Dobtun Jinpa, thank you so much for writing such a beautiful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Thank you, Greg. And thank you for having me and also giving me access to your, you know, listeners.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we will be previewing for you a fascinating documentary that airs tomorrow night on the PBS series American Experience called Murder of the President. It tells the story, it's really a tragic story, of the assassination of James Garfield. Not yet a year in office when he was cut down, but it was actually the incompetence of his doctors that really led most directly to his death. We'll be talking to the director and producer of the program tomorrow. It's on Wednesday that we'll talk about tonight's Iowa caucuses. We'll be welcoming into our studios Jeff Roberg and Jerry Mass to talk about Iowa. And on Thursday, a morning show I'm personally excited about as we preview for you something coming up this weekend, the world premiere of my first opera, an opera I composed called Black September, based on the tragic events of the Munich Olympic Games. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Sunny and mild today with a high of 39 degrees, but clouding up tonight with a 40% chance of light snow after midnight, a low of 28 degrees. We are sort of dodging the bullet here because much of Wisconsin will receive very, very heavy snowfall. For us, though, 1 to 3 inches, actually a mix of rain, sleet, and snow. And tomorrow's high, 36 degrees, just light snow on Wednesday. This is WGTD.